Hello and welcome to Politico's 2016 Nerdcast, where we bring you the stories behind the stories and geek out on this amazing circus of an election. It's Thursday, July 14th, and I'm Kristen Roberts, National Editor. Here are the numbers that mattered this week. Zero. That's the amount separating Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in the latest poll. 67, the percentage of American voters who think Clinton is untrustworthy. 10 million, the amount of money Trump is seeking from a former aide in a case about violating a non-disclosure agreement. And 5, in major Senate battlegrounds, GOP Senate margins are on average 5 points better than Trump's. So grab your calculators and enjoy the 2016 Nerdcast. All right, everybody. Hello to Charlie Mattesian, senior politics editor, my favorite guy from Philly.
Hi, Kristen.
Hello to Hadass Gold, who is everyone's favorite media reporter.
Hello.
And to Scott Bland, who is both the editor of Campaign Pro and always the smartest person in the room.
Hello, pod people.
All right, guys, before we launch into these numbers, we're going to do something new. We're going to hear directly from one of our listeners. So many of our listeners have sent us emails with comments and certainly criticisms, and we read this stuff, and it matters to us. So if you have a question or a comment, send it to nerdcast@politico.com. Let's welcome Kyle, who has a question about Libertarian Party coverage. Hi, Kyle.
Hi.
Where are you from, Kyle?
I'm from Baytown, Texas, about 30 miles east of Houston.
Who's your member of Congress?
Brian Babin.
Ah, got it. So that's the old Ron Paul seat?
It is the old Ron Paul.
Kyle, we were just talking about Ron Paul. So let me ask, if it were not Johnson, who's the Libertarian candidate now, I mean, who were you going for in the GOP primary, if anybody?
So, when in the 2012 election, I was this sort of idealist, and I said, I'm just voting for Johnson. And then for this election cycle, I said, you know what, I'm going up a little bit, I have to be more pragmatic. And I made a decision that I would probably vote Republican for any candidate except Donald Trump, and then, of course, he wins the nomination. But I really liked Rand Paul, obviously, initially. I thought it was good, but, I mean, any of the basic establishment candidates, I thought Jeb would have been a good one, and then I even would have taken Ted Cruz, because I think he still had some ground to talk about things like the Freedom Act that he voted for, even though he was, still farther right in trying to appeal to the religious right. I still thought I could still justify voting for basically any of them.
Kyle, you're in college?
Yes, sir.
You are so much smarter than I was in college. Oh, my God.
Okay, Kyle, what's your question?
I have found it interesting that this political cycle has seen more media discussion and coverage of the Libertarian Party. Now, I'm not dense enough to believe that the party will rise to prominence this election cycle. However, I am curious about the potential relationship between the growing interest in the Libertarian Party in conjunction with the seeming implosion of the GOP as we know it. It's my belief that if the GOP wants to win the White House again, there will need to be an embracing of some libertarian ideas. I personally think it's the only way to galvanize young votes, bring in more minorities, seem welcoming to the LGBTQ+ community, and take some of the high ground from the Democrats. I was curious y'all's view on this.
It's a really great question. It's something that we've struggled with here for a lot of years, and I think most news organizations struggle with the question of what to do, because we hear lots of complaints and criticism. Where's the coverage of the third parties? And I mean, one reason we don't is, and it's a pretty simple one, think about what happened at the Libertarian Party convention. A guy got up on stage, stripped down to his underwear. Now, that's not fair to peg and stick that on the Libertarian Party. Clearly, there were lots of people at that convention who were upset. But that goes way beyond even the worst case scenario at a major party convention where, say Clint Eastwood talks to an empty chair.
Right.
And it goes to the problem that we have, which is, if the Libertarian Party or if any third party or independent group can't sustain a level that puts it on the radar and makes it competitive with the other two major parties, we live in a universe of limited resources. We only have so many reporters and so much time and so many stories that we have to cover, and it's hard to cover somebody like Johnson who only won 1% in 2012. It's hard to justify that. And I say that as somebody who would love to be able to cover third parties more. And when I had a blog in 2012, I wrote a lot about Gary Johnson. He's a fascinating guy. He's been here several times. Many of us have met him, and he's a fascinating guy with a substantive record as governor.
You know, 12 is the cycle where I really started thinking about this too. And that's a credit to a cameraman who was on my team back then at Reuters, a guy named Tip McClure, who talked a lot about Ron Paul. What would have happened if the media gave Ron Paul as much coverage as gave the other two main candidates? And it's something that I've thought about every cycle since then. But the truth is, every morning, I mean, these are just the practicalities of a newsroom. Every morning you wake up, you have a certain number of people on your team. You deploy them in a way that allows us to break news on the big stories. And at some point, you frankly run out of human beings. When Johnson is a special case this year for me. You know, around the time that it became certain that Donald Trump was going to be the nominee and also remained certain that the Republican Party was divided, incredibly divided, more divided than any party in recent modern politics, it became incumbent upon us to cover any possible third-party candidate that could disrupt Donald Trump's efforts to unify the people to the right of center in America. And so we did in the beginning. In fact, I was made fun of a couple times on this Nerdcast for talking about Johnson so much. Your guy Johnson. At some point, it became clear, though, to me as a news manager, that he was going to play an insignificant role in the story of the 2016 election.
It's very much a chicken and an egg argument because, on the one hand, we won't cover him until he meets a certain threshold, meaning in his 2012 campaign, I think they spent $2.5 million. That's just not a credible number in a national presidential election. He got 1% of the vote. But on the other hand, he can't do better until he gets better coverage, meaning his argument when he came here a couple weeks ago was he has to hit that 15% threshold to make it in debates. He can't be a viable candidate until he gets into the presidential debates. And as the system is built now, you need a 15% polling threshold to get there. So it's really hard for him to break through unless we cover him, and we won't cover him unless he shows more viability. And that's a really big problem. And we really haven't resolved it yet. And if you take a look at his numbers in 2012, and again, I say this as sort of an advocate for more third-party coverage. Like, if you look at his numbers, even in the strongholds where he did best, he was in the single digits in his home state of New Mexico. He, you know, didn't have more than, I think, 3.5% of the vote. So it's very tough. And he's also up against one other big problem, which is the system is rigged against third parties. And what I mean by that is the American political system is built in such a way that it favors the two major parties, and it's like any other kind of regulatory system. Like, think about it this way. Every business, whether you're talking about barbers or lawyers or whatever, they try to set thresholds to keep people out, like bar exams.
Right.
States that want more lawyers have easy bar exams. States that don't need more lawyers or where they want to keep them out have
very hard
bar
exams. Barbers have to go to cosmetology school now.
Exactly. And some states are very different. And the politicians did the same thing. Nobody was watching. So over the decades, over the past century, they built a regulatory framework or a system of laws that benefits the major parties. And here I'm talking about things like signature thresholds, all sorts, you know, ballot qualification criteria. All of this is designed to further their duopoly and make it really hard for anyone else to challenge them. And this is what Johnson and other third-party candidates are up against.
Scott, you look like you want to jump.
No, I think just what Charlie just said, I think there have been really good examples in Arizona recently where the Republican Party blames libertarian candidates for costing them congressional seats in a number of recent elections. And so they've tried to push through new laws, massively upping the signature requirements for these candidates to get on the ballot. I think, you know, to the point of whether Johnson can kind of start building something more out of the Libertarian Party and injecting it into the conversation, I think it's worth noting that, you know, in other recent American elections where we've had two unpopular major party nominees, we've seen kind of brief flares of enthusiasm for libertarian candidates. The North Carolina Senate race in 2014, where both Democrat Kay Hagan and Republican Tom Tillis were super unpopular. You had a libertarian pizza delivery man named Sean Haw, who burst into the double digits in the summer in polling. And I think one of the other kind of threshold things that we need to, that we're always thinking about with this stuff is that, yeah, like this guy polled really well for a long time, and then he ended up getting about 3.5% of the vote. And we've seen time and time again these third-party candidates always underperform their polling when it actually comes time. And again, on top of that, now in the last 2 years in North Carolina, we haven't really seen any kind of building upon anything that this candidate built in 2014 when he had this opportunity. And you know, after seeing that again and again at the state level, you know, we wonder, okay, can Johnson maybe make something more of this moment at a national level and use that platform to start a conversation? But we just haven't seen it before.
Listen, Kyle, again, thank you so much for listening and thanks for emailing us.
Thank you so much for taking my question.
So let's talk about a data point that is brand new this very morning. It is zero. That is the amount separating Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in this morning's New York Times CBS poll. Zero. Not only has Donald Trump closed the distance, man, he looks in so many ways and in other polls like he is beating her out on key metrics when you dive into the crosstabs on this poll.
I thought the poll is a great corrective to the sort of widespread sentiment, at least in media circles, but I think also in other circles, that this was going to be a blowout. You know, lots of folks that I talked to, not just in the media, but also Democrats in particular, you know, just assume that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And that's been widely held for a long time. But I think because of some of the chaos we've seen in the Trump campaign, the lack of money and, you know, everything else about the Trump campaign, the idea was that Hillary Clinton was going to run away with this. And what we see from the polling is nothing could be further from the truth. This is a very, very close race. In fact, it's a dead heat in a highly respected poll. And, you know, it goes to show that for all his flaws, Donald Trump is in the hunt here. And Hillary Clinton is really struggling.
Hillary Trump, the Frankenstein candidate. It absolutely drives me crazy when, you know, I have, you know, friends or other people in Washington look to me and they look at me with this face that's like, well, there's no way Donald Trump is going to be president.
It happens all the time.
And I just want to shake them and say, oh, there is a huge, this is exactly what people said during the primaries. And it has a very, very real possibility of happening. And people are always trying to compare, oh, well, at this point in 2012, Obama was only ahead of Romney 1 point and et cetera, et cetera. But this is a race unlike one we've ever seen before. Our colleague Annie Carney, who covers Hillary Clinton, she just tweeted that the Dem think today is that the real baseline for the race will be 2 weeks after the conventions when the bumps have flattened and this is a, quote, weird time for polls. This whole year has been a weird time
That's
for
exactly
everything.
Right.
And so the Democrats might think that way, but here's the thing. I don't think everyday Americans care that Trump's campaign is chaotic. They don't care that he's, you know, has these weird people surrounding him. As you were saying, Kristen, on the metrics, on the economy, things like that, that's what they care about. And so they could care less whether he has a ground game. So we here in Washington might be like, oh, this is like a huge, you know, deal. He doesn't have a ground game. He doesn't have this. But when voters go into the voting booth, what's most important is like, who's going to make my life better next year?
So the timing of this actually is an important thing that I think we should talk about. A week or two, Hillary Clinton was experiencing a bit of a bounce, right? And she was experiencing that bounce as Trump was flailing in the Curiel period. You remember Judge Curiel, right? It seems so long ago. It wasn't so long ago. Then she had a terrible week. And when you look at this poll, one of the most interesting things here is the number 67. That's the percentage of voters who think Clinton is untrustworthy. Donald Trump's number is 62. 67 to 62. He's doing better on this metric than she is. And one of the reasons that most people think has to do with the email inquiry. You remember that was the biggest story of last week. And James Comey's testimony on The Hill about this, where he frankly said that she had not told the truth when she was appearing before Congress, sealed the thing that Donald Trump wanted it to seal. It sealed her. It made her look like Crooked Hillary, right? It made that nickname that he's created for her, like he creates for all of these other rivals he has, sticky.
Yes. And that's exactly when these polls were in the field. And that's what everyone was seeing in the news and in their newspapers and everything while they were answering these questions. Here's what I will say, though. Let's not fall into that like journalist trap of thinking just because Hillary Clinton was higher on the last polls and lower on these polls, that means she'll be lower still on the next ones, right? That we can draw a straight line through them. Because as we were saying, just 2 weeks ago, she was experiencing a bounce and she was higher than in her previous ones. We were thinking, is this going to be an upward trajectory that continues for a while? We have, over 100 days of this campaign left. We've got the conventions, we've got the debates. There's going to be stuff that happens. And right now, yes, the New York Times CBS poll is a respected poll. It is also one of the only ones that's even showed a tied race at this point. I think almost none have shown Trump in the lead. And so, you know, we shouldn't just because Clinton had a bad week, and I think that's pushing forward into this week because polls from that bad week are now coming out and kind of showing how bad it was. But, we may get back to the question, what can Trump do to keep that narrative in voters' imaginations? It's not going to be TV ads. It's certainly not going to be the way we're used to seeing campaigns accomplish this.
It's going to be a response to the news. I mean, that's what we've seen over and over again in this cycle. It's the news that is driving the candidates, and it's external factors. It's the state of race relations. It is an immigration question, right? It's the email stuff. It's not stuff that's really happening on the trail or from the stump speech. It's not a response to someone's relationship with the candidate. It's a response to the candidate's relationship with external factors.
I'm beginning to wonder if Bernie Sanders didn't do Hillary Clinton a disservice by taking the email issue off the table. I think he was widely lauded and celebrated within the Democratic Party for not using the email card early on, but she never got tested on it. And I think many Democrats thought it was a partisan issue. Certainly they dismissed it with the back of their hand, the campaign, that, oh, this is all ginned up stuff. It's nothing real. You know, yeah, we made a mistake. Let's move on. And it turns out, you know, in the wake of the FBI findings that, you know, it has more stickiness than we knew. It's not that the polls have spiked dramatically as a result of it, but it certainly hardened the sentiment against her and seemed to grow it a little bit. And now all of a sudden you've got a Democratic nominee where roughly two-thirds of the people think she's untrustworthy, and that's pretty staggering.
I don't know if Bernie going after her on this was going to make a big difference. I mean, the truth is that the Republican Party has an Oppo research operation inside the House of Representatives. They were going to drop this report anytime they wanted. They had her in a committee room swearing to tell the truth, and then they were able to drop a report and pull in James Comey and show time, you know, instance after instance that she had not told the truth. Whether Bernie challenged her on that or not back in January or February, I don't know that would have changed this situation.
And the public really respects what the FBI says, and they still have them in much higher regard than they might have for Congress or for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. So when the FBI director is saying straight out she didn't tell the full truth, that's huge.
My point's more about complacency, meaning oftentimes we note that in primaries, a candidate gets better by being tested by the fire, being forced to hone their answers and shape their responses and understand what issues are sticking, which aren't, what's volatile, what's working, what's not. And I think in this case, by dismissing it, taking it off the table, they may have done a disservice because they never had to come up with a different answer or prepare for an environment in which something like this might actually stick.
Well, you know what they may have done is they may have given her the nomination, because had it hurt her back then, we might have seen Biden. We might have seen Bernie Sanders doing much better in later states. Scott, you're staring at us.
Yeah, that sounds all right to me. I mean, I think what Charlie said about kind of the practice aspect of the primary is a really good point, and something that has kind of been like bizarrely like a lot of other things about this primary season we just lived through, a little like bizarrely out of whack. You know, I don't know if Trump's candidacy really evolved like during the primary, right, to a point where, you know, you could see him, oh, he started as this ragtag, you know, something or other, and really like pulled it together. He was flying by the seat of his pants the whole time, and mm-hmm. it worked. And so now, you know, you've got a situation with the Clinton campaign like bunkering down, and with Hillary Clinton herself again, where like yeah this really isn't something that she's dealt with, even though according to these polls it continues to be like the number one issue hanging over her head.
I mean, it seems like when Hillary Clinton does well against Donald Trump is when she kind of takes, it was when her team takes themselves out of the this is a normal campaign, you know, and when they do the punchy responses and things like that. I mean, Hillary, I think a lot of the trust issues people have with Hillary Clinton is really authenticity. And I think that when For example, Donald Trump flip-flops all the freaking time. He contradicts himself in like one speech all the time. He has exaggerated and he lies. And it's like, that is a proven fact. Like Donald Trump also lies all the time. But it's about like, oh, how many people like were maybe celebrating 9/11 and things like that. And it's a lot less about like national security issues in your emails, also because Donald Trump hasn't been in a position where he had to deal with national security interests.
And we haven't seen his emails.
And we haven't seen his emails, or his tax returns for that matter.
Noted.
And I think with Hillary Clinton, even when she's being authentic, even when her staff says, oh no, that like Hillary Clinton definitely carries hot sauce around in her pocket all the time, it doesn't come off like that. Our colleagues, Jake and Anna, had a great interview with Stephen Colbert where he talked about how he jokes about Hillary Clinton. He says, the fact that she lied to Congress helps. And then on one hand, she's a totally charming woman. And you just don't understand why, when there are more than five people in a room, she turns into like the host of a poorly rated local access children's show. She becomes very stiff and almost agonizingly needy to express her humanity. And I mean, I think that perfectly sums it up. It's people see Donald Trump as authentic because he says these ridiculous things, because he's like your crazy uncle who just like spouts off whatever's on his head. And they see that as authentic.
If there's a silver lining for Hillary Clinton, I think it's this. You know, sure, the poll, the new national poll that comes out today shows it's a dead heat. But we don't actually have a national election. We sort of have a national presidential election, but what really takes place is we have an election in 11 critical states, 11 swing states, and that is really what's going to determine the presidency. And right now, if you look at the 11 battleground states, if you look at the polling average, Hillary has the edge in all 11 of them, at least the 11 that we've determined to be the key battleground states this year. She's got a 4-point, five-point advantage there, and I think that's really going to be important to keep an eye on.
And that's where she's on TV, right? We've talked about this for a few weeks. Like, those are the places where people are actually hearing from her in exactly the way her campaign wants to be heard right. from, as opposed to kind of this halting kind of public appearance persona that Colbert describes, right? They're on TV. Priorities USA is on TV in the other direction, bashing Trump in exactly the way they want to be, the way they've tested, the way they feel most certain is going to work, and you know. It'll be interesting to see if there kind of remains any separation there. Usually you can kind of see a relationship between where the national polls are moving and what's going on in these state polls. And
well, hold on a second. Charlie, let me just ask a question of you. I mean, we've seen the Marist poll had Clinton ahead in Pennsylvania and Iowa, but Quinnipiac very recently, this week, had Clinton and Trump virtually tied in Ohio and Trump leading Clinton by 5 in Florida and 6 in Pennsylvania.
Choose your own adventure.
Well, maybe that's what it is. But how do you square the idea that she's doing well in the states that matter with the polling that we're seeing from Quinnipiac?
Well, I think it's just getting back to Scott's point. I mean, these are snapshots in time. They're not, you know, we can't base everything and rely everything on the polls because, you know, there are different methodologies, different screens. All of that is going to affect the outcomes of the polls. What I think is probably more useful at the end of the day is the point that ground game and TV, this is where it comes in. If it's still at 40%, if they're still tied at 40% in October, I'm going to put my money on the candidate who is on TV and the candidate that has field organization, because in a tight election, that's what's going to put one candidate over the edge. The person who has tons of volunteers across the country knocking on doors, making phone calls, driving people to the polls, who's on TV nonstop, carpet bombing the airwaves in the final weeks, that could end up making the difference.
Let's switch gears. Next data point, 10 million. This is the amount of money that Donald Trump is seeking in a lawsuit against one of his former aides for a violation of a non-disclosure agreement. This is happening on the eve of his convention, where he is supposed to secure formally the nomination. What is he doing?
So, to be clear, Donald Trump is not necessarily suing the former aide. His name's Sam Nunberg now. This lawsuit was actually brought back in May. And what Sam Nunberg is doing, perhaps on purpose, is this week he is responding in the Supreme Court of New York, trying, I think they're from not totally clear in legalese, maybe lawyer Charlie can help us on this, take it out of arbitration. He wanted to make this public. And Sam Nunberg, in his response to Donald Trump, not only exposed the fact that Trump was suing him for $10 million for breach of confidentiality, he also used the opportunity to expose various other rumors and things that had been floating around for a while, including a very salacious suggestion that there is currently there was an affair occurring between two top Trump staffers. And a bunch of other little details about the campaign. And clearly Sam Nunberg, who declared after leaving the Trump campaign, declared support for Ted Cruz, knows exactly what he's doing and did this on the eve of the convention for a reason.
Charlie, what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, I passed the bar, but I never practiced, so you definitely don't want legal counsel for me. But I will say the broader point here about the non-disclosure agreements and just the legal maneuvering between Trump and someone who was very close to his camp and was a big fan of his just goes to show you this is the risk that candidates have. This is the risk that the party has with Donald Trump, is that you have these kinds of distractions constantly swirling in the background. And I think that is actually the biggest risk to the Trump candidacy right now, is his own inability to be disciplined. Why is this out there? Why was this not taken care of? Nunberg is a guy with long ties to Donald Trump. Why are we dealing with this now? And I think that is where you've got the sort of critical problem at the heart, at the core of the Trump campaign, a lack of discipline and an inability to divorce itself from this kind of drama.
I also think, though, to some extent, there's so much of this that's going on. Doesn't this kind of bounce off a little bit?
I feel wonder.
Like it's one of those things done. That you see. It's like, oh, like a former staffer is suing Donald Trump for, or Donald Trump suing a former staffer for $10 million. That's original. Like, that sounds like the thing I heard last week and the week before that. It's, you know, this rolling
reality show.
Yeah, rolling reality show. Exactly. It's just, you know, and next week there will be another thing, probably in the middle of the convention. And at that point, we'll be asking, why this? Why now?
And this is what I'm saying. Like, I don't think that your voter in Ohio cares. I mean, I'm just thinking about, like, my people I know back in Arizona, which is not like Ohio at all. But, you know, they would be saying, yeah, he signed a confidentiality agreement. He was working on a campaign. He knows secrets. If he broke it, he should be punished.
I want to know what Trump and the Trump campaign is going to do during the DNC, right? During the Democratic convention to try, you know, will they be able to wrest any attention from the media spotlight that they're
I'm absolutely
fascinated those are the to stories, see what they pull out of their hat.
I want to be walking around the conventions with, like, live streams on every device I have of all the networks, because the moment they cut away from something going on at the DNC in favor, let's say Katy Perry is speaking, and they cut away to Donald Trump holding a rally somewhere, I mean, I can just imagine the phone calls flying into the CNN control rooms from Debbie Wasserman Schultz just screaming.
This is going to be one of the most interesting two conventions we have ever covered.
And it's my first.
I wanted to take this chance to introduce our listeners to the man who will be covering Donald Trump's running mate. His name is Matt Nussbaum. Hi, Matt.
Hi, good to be here.
We've got some Veep speculation swirling. In fact, by the time this podcast posts tomorrow, we might actually know who Mr. Trump's running mate is. So tell us about the field.
Well, so it looks like we're down to three, and that's Newt Gingrich, Chris Christie, and Indiana Governor Mike Pence. And as of right now, it looks like Pence has emerged as the front runner here. Now, he would bring a lot to the table for a Trump ticket. Obviously, compared to Gingrich and Christie and Trump himself, he's low-key, maybe even boring. But that's not necessarily a drawback on this ticket. He brings deep experience in Congress, where he was for 12 years. He was elected governor of Indiana in 2012 and has a very conservative record there.
He's got a conservative record, Matt, but he also has some problems. This guy is not without controversy. We're talking about a governor who lost a lot of his evangelical base by flip-flopping in their eyes on that religious freedom bill, no?
Yes, the religious freedom bill that was seen as discriminating against the LGBT community was very controversial out there. People point to that as the reason why his approval rating is down to 40% in Indiana, I think only 60% among Republicans. So he could be looking at a tough re-election fight just to stay as governor if he isn't picked as the running mate. That said, he brings a much stronger resume among evangelicals than Trump does. Maybe more importantly, he also has a lot of support among the conservative donor network, the Koch network. And that's a community that's extremely important in a national election and is not all that warm to Trump on his own.
That's actually really interesting, perhaps the most interesting thing that we'll hear about Pence. Thanks for joining us, and we will hear a lot from you over the course of the next 117 days.
Something like that. Thank you.
Next data point, 5. That's the average amount that Republican Senate candidates are running ahead of Donald Trump. Now, Scott, who, where, and why does it matter?
Yeah, so I think, you know, what we did is I pulled together polling averages from a bunch of the battleground states where there are concurrent, presidential battleground and Senate races going on, and took a look at them. So, for example, you know, in Ohio, Hillary Clinton is running about 2 points ahead of Donald Trump, according to the polling averages from the Huffington Post. On the flip side, though, in the Senate race, Republican Senator Rob Portman is running 2 points ahead of his Democratic challenger. In New Hampshire, Clinton running an average of 4 points ahead, but Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte still, on average, a point ahead. And we're seeing this all across the map. We're seeing this in Florida. We're seeing it in Pennsylvania. We're seeing it in Nevada, North Carolina, Arizona. And it's important because we've seen for years now this convergence of Senate and presidential results, you know, with very few exceptions now. If your state votes Democratic for president, it's going to vote Democratic for Senate. If it votes Republican for president, it's almost always going to vote Republican for Senate. And Democrats are starting to have been hanging their hats for months now on this idea that Trump is a kind of generationally problematic candidate for Republicans who's going to sink their down ballot candidates and help them take back Congress. And so far, it's just not happening.
Doesn't it go to show you, though, that if there had been any other candidate on the top of the ballot, any other more normal Republican, this would have been, I mean, all the indicators people were saying pointed towards a Republican victory this year.
Maybe. Couldn't you also flip that around and say that if there was a normal Democratic candidate who wasn't the second most unpopular presidential nominee ever, you know, maybe Democrats would be running away with it. I think there are a lot of people in both parties who regret a lot of things right now.
Charlie, come into this.
To me, it's just a reflection of some talented candidates on the Republican side. We're not talking about open races now. We're talking about incumbents who are weathering the storm in their states, or at least they've calibrated their response in a very smart way. They have established their own identities. People like Kelly Ayotte, Rob Portman. It's not easy for them. They're getting crushed every day, and you know, as we all know from our inboxes, being carpet bombed with emails about, you know, Rob Portman running away from Trump or whatever. I just think that those candidates have been very effective in establishing their own brand in most cases, not all of them, but in most cases, and have been able to differentiate themselves and create a political persona that enables them to get some distance from Donald Trump.
What are the odds right now on Senate returning to Democratic hands?
I think it's, you know, probably close to even. I don't know if I would tilt it too far in one direction or the other. I think that the thing that's really kind of keeping me up at night when I think about this and think about how to calibrate how I feel about these numbers is, you know, I remember in the spring and summer of 2014 when we were watching Southern Democratic senators who had, you know, longtime established personal brands, people like Mark Pryor in Arkansas, whose dad had been in politics before him, who ran TV ads where he was holding a Bible and talking about how his faith helped him get through cancer, and talking about how these Democrats were successfully establishing independent brands from Barack Obama and the National Democratic Party. And what happened? The bottom totally fell out in the fall. Pryor lost by like 15 points to Tom Cotton. And so that makes me really nervous, right, when I'm watching this. It's like, are we getting this right, like, just because that's the way it is at this moment in time?
Are we getting this journalistically right?
Exactly. Are we looking at these numbers right now, are we right to say that these Republicans are in fact avoiding Trump, or has he really just not crashed down on their heads yet?
God, that's an interesting point, because we have seen not only from Politico, but from everybody in the political space, frankly, a lot of stories about Republican Senate candidates racing to put distance between themselves and Donald Trump. It brings me back to something that we talked about earlier in the conversation, where we saw Hillary Clinton's numbers getting weaker, starting to realize, as Charlie said, that Donald Trump really does have a path and a chance. One of the things that has been dividing the Republican Party and keeping people from joining or lining up behind Donald Trump is the idea that he can't win, and so they need to be focused on House and Senate. Maybe that's just not true. Maybe we all misread that. Maybe they, the principals, misread that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, honestly, that's been one of the biggest signals, I feel like, for the idea that Trump doesn't have a chance. It's the unprecedented distance that Republican senators in these battleground states are putting between themselves and him. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see if that shifts at all. I think that would be a good sign over the next month or two to keep an eye on. And we've been tracking it pretty closely. You know, every time Donald Trump goes to one of these battleground states, I know I'm keeping a little spreadsheet on my computer. And Trump, you know, Fayetteville, North Carolina, was Senator Richard Burr there? Yes, no. Mm. What was the excuse? Smart. If not? And so, you know, over the next couple of months, I think that's a great metric to track, even more so than some of the polls in terms of how he's affecting everything and how people feel about him.
And here's the thing about the way the Republican Senate candidates interact with Donald Trump. I mean, mostly what this is they are engaged in an exercise of trying to avoid any political blowback because they are afraid the bottom might fall out of the Trump campaign and it might explode in spectacular fashion, dragging them all down to a horrible death. But here's the thing. In a couple of months, if he shows discipline, if he comes out of the convention with a bump, if it is a close race in October, you know, late September, when people are really paying close attention, people are not going to be sprinting away from the ticket. And you might even see some of those candidates on stage with Donald Trump if it turns out that he can be, and this is their fear, and they won't say it, but their fear is that he will not be a professional grown-up candidate and they will get splashed by it. And if he proves that he can be and show discipline, then they will come back because they have finely tuned political antenna. This is what they do for a living. They're great at sensing it. And if they sense it, if they feel it, they will start to embrace him.
And they also pay a lot of money for much better polling information than we have available for us.
They pay more money than he does, too, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point.
All right, before we say goodbye, I'm going to force you guys to do something that we never do. And that's tell listeners something about you. It can be you talking about your favorite book, or shout out of your favorite restaurant, or talking about how journalism is affecting your life in good and bad ways. I don't care. All I know is that we're getting lots of emails from our listeners, which I love. We all love. And the truth is they don't really know us very well. So, Charlie, you're first.
Okay, I'll share a story that I was telling all of you about earlier about my kids. So I've got two kids that are in grade school. And what I'm amazed by is how engaged and familiar they are with the presidential race. And I say that I'm amazed because we're not a very political household. Like when I leave Politico and go home, I have no interest in talking about politics. We don't sit around the dinner table talking about candidates or Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, nothing like that. We talk about sports or what books I'm reading or my obsession with getting my cat to stop pooping all over the basement. So that's what that's really
disgusting. Yeah,
I know. Don't even get me started. But I'm amazed at my kids, just organically, in their classrooms in grade school, they all know it. All their friends know the race. They talk about the race. They're familiar with Donald Trump. Now, you know, maybe it's just a reflection of like what a savage I was as a kid, that I knew nothing about politics or the presidential race. But to me, it's at a level that I am stunned by. I think it's remarkable how engaged all these kids are. And you know, to take a sort of Pollyanna-ish angle to this, this could be a great thing one way or another. I'm trying to find a silver lining here, of course.
Seriously.
You know, I mean, maybe their formative experiences, they're going to learn that politics matters and candidates matter and that they can't disengage. And maybe ultimately a generation from now, maybe that, you know, it changes the way people feel about the system.
Yeah, Scott, you're next. But first, I want to say the thing that I worry about with that, because my kid and all my kids' friends are experiencing this too. I'm worried that the kids are going to be so turned off by the nastiness that they disengage. Like the millennial generation is engaging in a way that my generation did not when we were at their stage. I'm worried about our kids' generation just saying, I want nothing to do with this nastiness. Your turn, Scott.
Yeah, just a really quick thing to say. I want to just give a little shout out to Charleston, South Carolina, where I had never been before last week and where my wife and I went on vacation. And it is an awesome city.
It's
I know
beautiful.
It's very, very unusual, I know, for a political reporter to make it to their late mid-20s without going to the great state of South Carolina, I know. But I went for the first time. It was fantastic. It was great food, yeah. Great people, great beaches. It's a great, great place. I encourage everyone to go there.
It's beautiful. Hadas.
I'm going to give a sappy shout out to my fiance, Chris, who has had to suffer not only through me working insane, but also as we plan our wedding. We've been going through all the motions, and it's kind of a little bit crazy when it involves an election season at the same time. So
has the election forced you guys to change plans?
Yes, it has.
That's hard.
It's hard, but I think at the end of the day, it will still be a fantastic and very fun party. And my wedding will have absolutely nothing related to campaigns in it. People ask me, like, oh, are you going to give out, like, you know, Donald Trump things or Hillary Clinton buttons at your wedding? And I'm like, hell no.
Oh, my God. All right. So I want to talk about something that's personal slash professional. There's a man named Jeff Mason. He is White House correspondent for Reuters. He's the incoming president of the White House Correspondents Association, and he and I go way, way back. I consider him one of the most ethical, professional, stand-up kind of journalists in the world. He and I sat together in the White House booth the night President Obama announced that he'd gotten Osama bin Laden. It was just one of these experiences that will link Jeff and me together forever and ever and ever. And Jeff today did something that I really respect. He, as the incoming president of the WHCA, put out a statement saying that the WHCA is worried about the tone and tenor of this presidential race and worried about press freedom. And in a race that has so affected so many of our lives, in a race where our reporters are on blacklists, are being denied credentials, in a race where I spent very many mornings and late nights talking with political operatives who are screaming at me and blacklisting my reporters and really disrespecting the institution and not recognizing that for America to be great, it needs a great free press. I appreciate what Jeff Mason has done today. And that's it for us. Scott Bland, please say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Hadas.
Bye.
Charlie.
See ya.
Thank you to our listeners again. We appreciate you. Keep listening. If you liked our show, please subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us, and look for us on Stitcher, SoundCloud, or your favorite podcast app.